Who is the most quoted writer in popular discourse? Shakespeare? Oscar Wilde? Or what about the guy being paraphrased here by Donald Tusk when, as president of the European Council, he criticised the instigators of Brexit?
We will not gamble with peace or put a sell-by date on reconciliation. And this is why we insist on the backstop. I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it safely.
Special place in hell. The politician Donald Tusk, the artist Sandro Botticelli, later William Blake, Augusto Rodin, Salvador Dali and James Joyce, all inspired by the work of the Italian writer Dante, who created the Divine Comedy some 700 years ago. The Divine Comedy gives us a vision of heaven, hell and purgatory that has seared into the collective imagination. And we've asked Trinity College's Enrica Maria Ferrara to bring us through the work and to show us why it's such a seminal piece of writing. Enrica, Dante, or Dante Alighieri, as we can call him, born in Florence in the 13th century. We know the great love was Beatrice. We know about his trip to hell, heaven and purgatory that you're going to tell us more about. But the man behind all of that, a soldier, a civil servant, what type of person are we talking about?
Yes, he was. Thank you, Sean. Yes, he was a soldier. He was a civil servant. He held quite a few political offices. But in reality, what he really was and he wanted to do was to be a poet and to study philosophy. He was a great poet and a great philosopher. And you mentioned Beatrice, the love of his life. He met her when he was only 9. And then he met her again when he was 18. And that love sparked. This was the kind of platonic love and spiritual love, and in fact she becomes his guide in the Divine Comedy. She symbolizes poetic salvation and grace in the Divine Comedy. She died very young in childbirth in 1290, so she was dead in fact at the time when he portrayed her in the Divine Comedy.
You mentioned he met her when he was 9 and then again at 18. That 9, we'll find, is very important indeed. So the Divine Comedy then, if I refer to it as an epic poem, am I using a correct term there in that we have this hero, I guess, in Dante heading off on this journey, quite a set of places he's sending himself to?
Yes, absolutely. You can define him. You can define it an epic poem in the same way that the Iliad and the Odyssey by Homer, or the Aeneid by Virgil, they were epic poems. And the main thing about this poem to be defined as epic for me is its theatricality. So, like, it is a very theatrical poem. Originally, epic poems were oral poems that were sung by bards, used metric forms and scheme to memorize them. And this is a particularly revolutionary piece of work, you know, like from Dante, because Dante wrote this work in the vernacular. And vernacular, you know, like was the language that actually was Italian, Florentine based, you know, at the time. And so it was very easily memorized. And in fact, it was among the common people that was very popular, the comedy, you know, with an oral tale before becoming, you know, like the written author. Iterative poem, you know, like that became.
Yeah, so I'm interested in that oral aspect of that you're talking about there, and the fact that it was kind of a tale of the common people. So did he write it then in a Florentine dialect, or was it put into a courtly type of Italian later on, or did it remain in that dialect?
No, it was written in that dialect. It was written in the Florentine dialect, in the vulgar, in the vernacular, you know, if you wonder, this is how it was called. But at the same time, it was also a plurilinguist language. You know, it was a language full of Latinism. It was a language full and open to other dialects, and to other cultures. So it was exactly, you know, it was a language of the people, but with a refined touch, you know, like it was a refined slant. And it is one of the reasons why the Divine Comedy, I think, is so very good, so apt to be recited aloud. You have so many examples of podcasts, for example, online for the Divine Comedy. And there is a podcast, an audiobook that has been produced this year for the 700th anniversary in 33 languages, would you believe? And it will be presented at the Italian Culture Institute on the 25th of March.
Well, let's get a sense then of the type of journey that he goes on. How important is the time that he, because he's heading there, it's Dante himself in Easter week of 1300 who's heading off on this journey. That's a very contemporary take on it, I suppose, for the readership and the audience of the day. Mm. How important is that? How important is the Easter week aspect of the setting and time?
So it's the Easter week. So like it was the 1300 was the year of the Jubilee. So like it was a religious time. It was a religious occasion to repent, you know, like from your own sin and kind of acquire salvation for the purgatory souls. But at the same time, the 1300 is a very, very important year for the political history of Florence and for the personal history of Dante, because Dante was a member of the White Guelphs, and the White Guelphs and the Black Guelphs were contending Florence. They were engaging in a very bloodthirsty battle at the time. And Dante, as a result of this battle in 1302, was exiled from Florence. And the this is very important, you know, like for the future, you know, for his writing on the Divine Comedy, because the fact that then he wrote the comedy and started writing the comedy in 1306 allowed him, by setting it in the 1300, to have a retrospective look on what had already happened. So the character Dante in the comedy became a sort of prophet of events that had already happened at the time of writing. And this also allowed him to throw in hell some of his enemies. So the people that he considered responsible for his exile and he deemed responsible for the moral corruption and violence that were tearing his homeland apart. So the fact, the very interesting thing is that it's probably the first work of literature in which the personal and the political dimensions are one thing.
I get the impression from what you're saying there that it was a very political poem then in its day, speaking directly to those that Dante wanted to hit back at. And it's the nine, we're at that figure as well, the nine circles of hell.
Yes.
You don't want to be too far down those circles, do you? It's quite a horrific vision that he gives us.
It's an horrific vision that he gives us, you know, like it very much ties in with the religious, belief, you know, like of the time, the hell, the purgatory, and the nine circles, you know, like the further down you go into the circle of hell in this like funnel-shaped inverted cone that is the creator of Inferno, and the further down, you know, like the more wicked are the sins, you know, they are punished in those lower circles. So in the first circle, so you are punished for sins of incontinence. So you're not able to resist your passions and you're not able to resist, you know, the lure of your sins. So it's lust, it's gluttony, it's greed. And then, like, the farther down you go, like, you have the more wicked sin there, the sin of violence, violence against others, violence against God, and violence against nature. So the blasphemous, the sodomites, and the murderers. And then, like, the farther down again in the eighth circle and the ninth circle, the sinners who are who commit fraud and malice, you know, like sins linked to fraud and malice are punished there. So you have, I mean, like there is a huge, you know, like a long list, you know, like you have pimps and seducers and flatterers and simoniacs, who are those who sold church favors and offices. And then you have the barristers, who corrupt politicians. You have hypocrites, thieves, and false counselors. And there's all sort of terrible and horrific punishments that Dante imagines
right,
for
so
this.
Corrupt politicians end up in circle eight of hell, along with thieves and false counselors. Who's down below that then?
False counselors, you know, like one famous, apart from the Brexiteers, you know, like one famous false counselors that is down there is Ulysses.
Yeah.
And Ulysses is punished for the trick of the Trojan horse and other terrible sins like this. And the one particular sin, you know, that is the fact that he convinces his crew to sail across the Pillar of Hercules and die in shipwreck. He had, if you want to call it, the gift of the gab. So he convinced, you know, his crew to essentially to go to death, you know, to their death, because the world ended at the end of the Pillars of Hercules. But those verses are, I think, were some of the best examples of Dante's the verse in the Divine Comedy.
Yeah, but there is a lower level than level 8, level 9. These are the causers of division. Who was he?
Yes.
And I presume this was a direct comment on the society he was writing in.
Yes, the causes of division, definitely. You know, like those that were causing discord and conflict in society and politics. So it was those, you know, like that he wanted to hit. And for example, down there is Bertrand de Born, who caused the conflict between Henry II of England and his son. And so he was beheaded. And his punishment is that he has to carry around his head severed from his body. He's, in fact, you know, like this happens according to the law of contrapasso, which is like the law that Dante defined and devised, you know, like for assigning the sins, you know, counter penalty.
Idea that whatever you did bad on earth, you'll get some version of that down below.
Absolutely. An eye for an eye, you know, like that kind of thing, you know, like so the punishment is devised, you know, like a sort of karma or poetic justice. Yeah. So they either resemble the sin or are in contrast with the sin. But you know, like they really are horrific.
Give me an example of one of the most salaciously, deliciously horrific punishments.
Me, you know, like, the boiling river of blood for the murderers is terrible, but also the flatterers have to sink in their own excrement, you know, which is like pretty bad, I suppose. You know, like the barriers, so like the politicians, the corrupt politicians, have to be immersed in boiling tar. That is a reference to corrupt and shady and sticky deals, and others. You know, like there's like this. People turning into snakes, yeah. and the falsifiers and imposters suffer terrible disease like leprosy, rabies, dropsy, and stinking fever. Yeah. There's a thing called stinking fever. It's not the coronavirus, but it's something.
So hell is a pretty horrific place, and fire is everywhere. There's fire all over the place, but not when we get to Lucifer himself.
No. No, exactly. And there is a frozen lake, and the fact that there is ice down there is significant because it is a symbol of the, you know, the fact that the cold blood and the hatred that defines the traitors are the ones that are down there in the ninth circle of hell. And Lucifer is trapped in the ice from his waist down and has three faces of three different colors. And these three faces munch and gnaws the highest traitors of humanity and God. So these are Brutus and Cassius, who are those who killed Julius Caesar, and of course Judas, the apostle, you know, betrayed Christ.
Yeah. So obviously hell is the place you want to avoid. I should say that Dante doesn't go off on this journey all by himself. He has Beatrice with him. Who else is with him?
Virgil is there. Virgil's a Latin poet, and who's there? And, you know, Virgil would not be allowed actually to go through either hell or, you know, like he's actually stuck in limbo. He's an unchristian. So he's stuck in limbo, but he's given a special dispensation to accompany Dante. And then there is Beatrice, of course, in Paradiso, in paradise. And yes, you know, these are the guides, you know, like that are taking him through his journey.
But I wonder then to what extent, you know, are the trips to purgatory and the trip to paradise, are they as colourful as the wonderful nature of the trips to hell, the nine circles of hell? The number nine continues to be important, isn't it? Seven balconies we have in purgatory with and two kind of annexes or whatever that add up to nine again.
Yes, so it's still nine levels, you know, if you want to call them, you know, with the anti-purgatory, and then like you have like the seven terraces corresponding to the seven deadly sins, and then you have the earthly paradise on the top. It is, would you believe that Joyce and Beckett considered purgatory the best of the three worlds? Because it was a place that it was like more resembling life, while hell was so extreme and paradise was so extreme in the other way. So, But I personally think that purgatory is a beautiful, gives us beautiful examples of the journey.
And is it the case then in purgatory that those who are on the balconies or in whatever the anterooms, that they're learning their lessons here and eventually they'll get it right and they can proceed up to the higher level?
Exactly. So like there's a better atmosphere in the sense, you know, like in the purgatory, because like, you know, that your soul will be saved. So like, you will be cleansed, you know, like, and it doesn't matter what, you'll be saved in the universal judgment or whatever it is. But apart from the fact that, you know, you have an actual penance to endure, for example, the proud have to carry a huge stone or the envious have to have their eyes shut with wire. You have also examples of the consequences of sin and examples of the virtue that you have to pursue, that they are either engraved on the terraces or they come to you in the shape of voices and stories that are told. So it is very interesting the way also Dante uses art in a sense, you know, like as a tool to enhance, you know, like yourself and cleanse your soul.
So art is seen not as a penance, but as a kind of a mode of teaching, is there, a mode of learning?
Yes, it's modern learning. Yes, it is, and it's a bit indoctrinating in a sense, you know, like as well, you know, like it is not, you know, it has to be a use, but at the same time, it's a cathartic tool, you know, like to elevate your soul.
Now, what about when we get into paradise then? Does it become too much of a good thing the higher up the circle as you go there? Or you're in spheres really when you get to to paradise, aren't you? Nine different
yes,
spheres.
Yes, you are in spheres. You know, like you have to remember that, of course, you know, this is a Ptolemaic and geocentric idea of the Earth. Mm. So, like, there are nine concentric and spheres, you know, like they are all concentric, you know, like all spaced, you know, like around the Imperius. And this is where he wants to get, you know, like obviously Dante wants to get to God. Now, it gets a little bit too much in the sense that it is very challenging to describe the essence of God, of course, you know, like, and it's also very challenging for Dante to describe the fact that he is getting to paradise with his whole body. So the whole purpose of his journey and the whole peculiarity of his journey, that he goes all the way through hell and purgatory and heaven with his flesh, in his flesh.
Right.
So yes, and there are very you know, poetic and beautiful verse in the Paradiso, but there's also a lot of doctrine, and there are many religious aspects. You know, you have to explain the religion and explain the love that emanates from God and makes all the spheres moving.
I mentioned some of the, you know, the influences and some of the various artists and writers that have been inspired by Dante down the ages. I mean, it's an endless list really, but I'm wondering to what extent you started by telling us about this oral tradition and how, in fact, it has that vernacular quality in the writing. Does it still have a place in popular culture in Italy and indeed, or because it strikes me that around the world, it's really an academic study now rather than a kind of, it wouldn't be thought of as being rough and vernacular now, would it?
No, but we have a very famous comedian, that is Roberto Benigni, who is the director of La Dolce Vita. You probably remember The Beautiful Life. You remember this movie that was very, very famous. And he has performed Dante, you know, like in a popularized version. And he actually goes on stage and recites the Commedia, making it relevant for the people. And this has been something that is done in the last few years. But there is also so many examples of street art and you have graffiti in the street and you have comic books, but you also have video games inspired to Dante.
Oh.
There is a famous video game that was made in 2010, Inferno, and has Dante as a knight, as a Templar knight, and going through the different levels, you know, like in the different circles of hell, at the different levels of the game.
It's not all high-flown art thought when it comes to Dante and the Divine Comedy. Listen, thanks so much for explaining some of that to us and opening up to us this evening, Enrica. That's Enrica Maria Ferrara. The Dante Public Lecture Series in Cork is organised by Dara O'Connell, features international scholars from all over the world. Starts on the 1st of February with Zig Baranski on Paradiso 24. That's the 24th book. And Enrica Maria Ferrara is the editor of Posthumanism in Italian Literature and Film, Boundaries and Identity. And that's published by Palgrave Macmillan, and it'll be launched at the end of this month.